And it's 10 and a half minutes after the hour on our Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning here. I'm Jim Park, and joining us an hour early, and we're glad that he is Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, the Executive Director of SAME, a ministry that does just some... You're really a worldwide ministry now, aren't you? Because you've got things going out to kids in Asia and India.
Yeah, I mean, when you do things primarily on the internet... Yeah, I guess you can be just about anywhere. And when I look at our database, we've got people from Africa and what used to be Eastern Europe and all throughout Europe and Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, obviously as well as North America here. So somehow the word spreads.
Well, of course, we kind of discover the same thing here at Broken Road as an internet station. We've had listeners from Hungary and Germany and down in Antofagasta, Chile, a city I'd never heard of, but we greet them every morning. And Canada, a lot of Canadian listeners, and in England. So yeah, it makes for an interesting challenge, I think. In terms of a scope of your operation, do you just keep doing the same thing and just allowing people from all over to get it, slowly kind of grow into it, or do you direct programs at specific areas of the world? That's a big undertaking.
It's real hard for me to direct anything towards a specific area of the world based on what we do. But what is interesting, as you know, every month we publish an article on some aspect of biblical context, and we call that a reflection. And that goes obviously worldwide. And then I start to get feedback from people from different parts of the world. And so after a while, you begin to understand how the world views slightly are different in different parts of the world. And you learn some things, and you keep learning some things. For example, 3-4 years ago, whenever I would routinely make a reference to first century, what I now call Israel, I would say first century Palestine. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole interesting story behind that, but how that came to be. But I got an email from a person who was the executive director of a messianic Christian ministry in the UK. And he said, "I love your monthly emails, but whenever you say first century Palestine, I will not copy that your email forward to my staff." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, because first century Palestine is not an appropriate reference. It was called first century Israel. And only after Hadrian, the Roman emperor, mm-hmm. general, conquered Israel in 135 AD, did he make reference that we were no longer call this land Israel, but call it Palestine. And so, obviously, the word Palestine and Palestinian has overt political implications to it these days. And so, that particular subset of Jewish people was really offended by my calling it first century Palestine, which would indicate politically that the Palestinians had a claim on that land even in the first century. Now, the root word for Palestinia does come from the Philistines. And of course, that's 1,000 years earlier when they were down in the Gaza area. And of course, we had David and Goliath and what have you. And so that's sort of the origin of the word Palestine. And then it really gets fascinating politically. When the Zionist movement first started to spring up in the mid-1800s, let's say, it did in Britain, pretty much around London. And shortly thereafter, we're dealing with a British prime minister named Disraeli, who is a Jew. And he was sympathetic towards Israel having its own state, if you will. But because of his Jewish background, he didn't want to refer to it as Israel. And so he began to call that Palestine, made reference to it. And from about the mid-1850s on, there has been a remarkable revisionist thing going on with British publishers, map makers, et cetera, to reinsert the word Palestine for the first century in place of Israel. And so that today, if you say to people, well, technically, it really is first century Israel. You really shouldn't make reference to first century Palestine. I mean, you'll say, no, you can't be right. I mean, there are all kinds of books, there are all kinds of maps that call it Palestine in the first century. And you'll say, yeah, that's because for at least 150 years, there's been some revisionist writing going on to sort of make it look that way. But technically, it never was. So I probably bored you with that explanation.
No, that's fascinating. And the part that is... The question I have now is Disraeli being sensitive to his Jewish or Hebrew background, was he embarrassed by it, or simply it was politically inadvisable to be Jewish? Because there was this kind of hatred, this notion that the Jews killed Jesus and they were evil, and that thought has worked against the Jews all over the world ever since the crucifixion. People have had it in for them for that reason, and it's obviously spurious. I mean, it's silly, but it's not silly when it results in the deaths of millions of people. And I'm just wondering if what Disraeli had in mind and in his heart was what eventually grew into be this this rampant hatred of Jews in Europe through the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
I don't know the mix of Disraeli's motivations. I think a good bit of it was political. He just deemed it as the prime minister. It probably was not good if a Jewish prime minister started promoting Israel. I mean, the biblical name Israel. Yeah. And so he was much more comfortable with the word Palestine, to use that in the public concourse. And but anyway, you know, we got onto this because you get hearers and listeners from different readers, different parts of the world, and you start learning some things from their perspectives that you never really appreciated before. So not that you would ever know, and not that would anyone would ever know, but from that day on, after researching this issue a little bit and realizing there was a considerable validity to it, you will no longer find a reference to first century Palestine in any of my writings. Mm-hmm. It's all now first century Israel.
Well, frankly, I'm glad to see it. But on the other side of that coin is, when you're dealing with people around the world, do you get a sense of the commonality, what we hold highest and dearest, and that we share some things there? In other words, the good news has gotten to the four corners or not?
Oh, absolutely. And the hearts for people for the Lord from all over the world almost puts the heart of the average Western evangelical to shame. I mean, you'll detect much more passion and much more zeal from many other parts of the world, particularly South America and Africa, than we seem to have a zeal for the good news of Jesus here in the West. And it's invigorating in many, many ways. And also, you know, when several thousand people read your article every month, you get a lot of editing. You get a lot of people, you know, asking questions. And so I'm really fortunate. By the time some of these articles get around to being published in book form, they've been edited by several thousand Christians from all kinds of different perspectives and worldviews from around the world. And I think it really makes for a tighter final edition, if you will, reflecting issues that perhaps I in the West was not particularly sensitive to or didn't particularly look at through a certain pair of eyes, so that a chapter in a book ultimately ends up to be much more seasoned, if you will, or tempered by the perspectives of all these people. I mean, you ever thought about the fact what it's like to have 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 editors every month reading your stuff and sending you emails with comments, suggestions, questions, maybe pointing out an inconsistency or two? I mean, another thing you probably would never know is that for that reason, I send my weekly or monthly reflection articles out in a series. So I'll send out maybe 1,000 one month, and then 1 week, and then I'll wait a week before I send out the next 1,000, because the final distribution to the last, you know, 500 people in the mailing list, sometimes the article, the monthly reflection, will be just a little bit different from how it started.
Well, I can imagine that back and forth and that trading of ideas and taking some criticism, taking some heat, because when you write those, your heart's there. And when someone takes issue with it, it can be difficult to deal with. But what a learning opportunity for you too, I would think.
Well, it is. And you have to have thick skin most of the time. Whenever you truly open up a passage and restore it back into its three-dimensional contextual setting, that story, that narrative is bigger, wider, and deeper than we are used to experiencing. And so the applications and the implications are deeper and wider. And you start to point out some things that no one has ever thought about before. And then there's in any organization, and it's true in Christianity as well, there is a certain set of, I'll call them traditionalists, who will say, oh no, that's not the way I was told that story. That's not the way I understand that story. That can't be correct. And so not only will there be people disagree, but the hardest part of this, what we do here at one level, is the people who simply take a particular passage that gets reconstructed in a wider, deeper way and say, cancel, mm-hmm. unsubscribe me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to listen to this stuff anymore. And so it takes a little perseverance sometime to keep on keeping on, because you know you're pushing people's paradigms and traditional understandings of Christmas, of Easter, of the last mm-hmm. words of Jesus, those kinds of things, because they do get bigger, deeper, and wider and fuller of implications and applications when they get put back into the three-dimensional first century village agrarian perspective. And it doesn't necessarily square up with this 21st century Western, urban, technocratic, postmodern world that we live in and the traditional way that many of these passages have been handled.
Yeah, and of course, that was the same challenge the apostles faced to begin with. And so of the saints and all the other Christians that have taken the good news into the world, they've been pushing other paradigms out of the way. And sometimes you meet downright nasty resistance.
If you look with Jesus and you start with Jesus, you see that's exactly what he's doing, and mm-hmm. that's exactly what he's experiencing. He went into observant Judaism, the most rigorous, demanding religious system of its day. He picked 10 of his original 12 disciples from that religious culture, and then began to systematically tear down, yank away from them, shred their paradigms of everything that religious Judaism had taught them to be right and true. He said, your view of God, it's not big enough, it's got to go. Your view of Gentiles, it's got to go. Your view of prayer, it's got to be changed. Your view of people with disabilities, it's got to go. Your view of lepers, it's got to go. I mean, right on down the line, what we miss is that these disciples were living in sort of a daily shock therapy experience with Jesus as he started this process of remaking them into being his disciples of the kingdom of God. And so, you know, I often say disciples of Jesus are people who are being radically detoxed from everything that this world and our cultures and our ethnicities have taught us is right and true. And that has to go. If it isn't, we'll never be fully open to fall in love with and embrace, and let alone get passionate about this organic thing that Jesus calls the kingdom of God. And so when you come at it through a very narrow window, like re-educating people about how to view and interpret scriptures, you're changing their paradigms. And people resist change, at least the vast majority of people seem to do. And so, that's sort of welcome to our world. We love to do it because when people are open to that change and they do start to rechange and their paradigms and start to see scripture in a fully three-dimensional way and the real Jesus in 3D, mm-hmm. it takes their breath away.
Well, it does. And that's the other side of the coin we've seen here too with your own Bible Alive seminar up in our neck of the woods just a month and a half ago. People's eyes got open, and so many were receptive to that and eager for more. They're eager to go back to their own Bibles now and look at things differently and fill in some of those blanks, the blanks that have always been there since maybe childhood, and now they're starting to see it filled in. I should mention to listeners that if you'd like to subscribe to Doug's monthly reflections. You can certainly do that over at preservingbibletimes.org. There's no charge. It comes to you via email. It's great reading. And sometimes you take issue with it, and that's okay. Wrestling with those things is what it's all about. And we love to do that here at Broken Road Radio. Doug, you're teaching us about shepherding in first century Israel. We've learned a lot about the shepherds themselves, about kind of the economy of sheep, why they were important. All of this is important because, you know, the Lord makes so many references to shepherds and shepherding and sheep, and understanding just what that relationship was between a shepherd and sheep is instructive to us. Last week we covered grass, and this week water. What do you have to say about water? What part does that play in the grand scheme of things?
Well, we're connecting our observations to Psalm 23, and of course with green grass, you know, it evokes that phrase, "He makes me lie down in green pastures," and we talked a little bit about what that meant last week. And David also talks about, "He leads me to still waters." So I want to deal with this notion of still waters for 10 minutes or so for our thoughts today. Grass and water are the two essentials for sheep. You know, with all that wool that they carry around for most of the year, and that southern Judea is a very hot place, at least 6, 7, 8 months a year, you can imagine how much sheep sweat. And so there's a lot of water that needs to be replaced in a sheep on an ongoing basis. Now, if you've ever been to Judea, you realize how scarce water is. 25% of the rainfall falls on 75% of the land, and that 75% of the land is in the south, and 25% is pretty meager when we're talking 10, 12, 15 inches maximum rainfall a year. And most of that water is going to fall in a 10 to 12 week window of time. Early, mid, and late winter. There really is no rainfall in the late spring. There is no rainfall in the summer. There is no rainfall in the fall. And so, you know, if you have to provide water to your sheep every day in a water-challenged environment, you as a shepherd have got a lot of thinking, a lot of planning, a lot of managing to do that your sheep will never know or understand. But it has to be done if they're going to be sustained on a daily basis. And so there's three ways that you can provide water to your sheep. One is from wells, and most of the wells tend to be around villages, which is why the villages are there, so that they can draw upon water. But because, as we talked last week, to find green grass, you sometimes have to roam 40, 50, 60 miles away from home. There are not a lot of convenient wells. And so you have to plan ahead to store water, if you will, in two kinds of places. Cisterns and lagoons. And talk about cisterns for a moment. Those are 10 to 15 foot deep holes in the ground that are probably 4 to 6 foot wide at the mouth. And they are literally hewn out of soft limestone. You're not going to be able to do this if it's hard limestone because it's too hard. And so right out of the chute, we realize that a good shepherd has to be a geologist. He has to know the difference between soft limestone and hard limestone. But there's more to it than that. How are you going to get water into these cisterns? Well, the first thing you have to figure out is strategically where you're going to place the cistern so that you can force winter rains to drain into it. There's a phrase that's used for creek beds. It's an Arabic phrase. It's called wadis. And most of the year, we're dealing with wadis that are dry. But during this 8 to 10 week window of time when we have the winter rains, the wadis become creeks, sometimes rarely, but sometimes a small river, flowing with water when there's a winter storm. Now, we need to do a little bit of soil consideration here as well. There is a kind of soil dust in Judea that's called loess. or probably a better pronunciation is LOESS, L-O-E-S-S. It's often at the micron level, very fine dust, sort of a powdery soil that blows through the air. Sometimes when there's a sandstorm and a lot of LOESS gets put into the air, it can become very, very dark, which might suggest an explanation for why Jerusalem was dark not from noon until 3, mm-hmm. the day that Jesus was crucified. But this LOESS blows, and as it blows across the landscape with the winds, and there are a lot of prevailing westerly winds in the day and easterly winds at night, this LOESS, this particulate matter, tends to congregate in lower places, typically in valleys. And when the first winter rain comes, this LOESS, when it becomes moist, becomes almost like a plaster. And so it hardens the ground, and the water from the winter rains is not able to seep in. And so when you get a winter storm and a sudden winter storm, and you have this LOESS sealant formation on top of the soil, none of the water gets absorbed. And so it starts to run sometimes violently through these valleys, steep, narrow valleys. And so what a shepherd will do is to look at the lay of the land, understand where he's got soft limestone possibilities, and he will dig a cistern in a certain place nearby a wadi, and particularly in an area of the wadi when he feels he can build a small rock dam to divert water from these winter storms and force it to flow over towards the mouth of this cistern. And in those ways, he will fill up these cisterns with water over time for storage that he can use in the hot summer months.
I'm thinking shepherds are close to the land. To learn that must have taken generations of failure and success and experimentation, and eventually becomes ingrained at that level of the culture. I wonder if there were specialists back then that read the water table and knew how water flowed and knew the area. Because I'm finding it hard to understand that a shepherd with 100 sheep would have time to do all this. I mean, they're busy people.
Well, they're busy people, but they have as many sons as they can have, and that is a lot of what the young sons do. Hmm. They dig out cisterns. Hmm. Well, dad is watching the flock. It's a family enterprise. Sometimes, you know, because one family is overseeing all the sheep for a village, the whole village knows you need cisterns. So you've got other younger young men that you can draw upon and other older men that you can draw upon. So, you know, this is all about community as well, and the community banding together to provide the resourcing needed to protect the community's assets, which are sheep and goats, primarily. And so, that's how it takes place. Now, there's another issue here. Not all limestone is soft in southern Judea. There's a lot of hard limestone as well. And so sometimes you're in a wadi situation where you could see a great water diversion possibility, but the ground is too hard to do a cistern. And so you'll survey the land, that is to oversee it, walk it, look at it, and try to find a depressed area that would make for a nice, what we would call, lagoon. And so when the shepherd finds that option in hard limestone territory, he will then do some diversionary work, again, with these dams of rocks, so that in the wintertime, when the winter storms come, some of the water will be diverted over into the lagoons. Now, hard limestone is not permeable. So if you put water into a hard limestone lagoon, the water won't seep away. It only evaporates. However, if you put water into soft limestone, it tends to absorb because soft limestone is porous. So every time you do a soft limestone cistern, you have to plaster it to make it water impermeable. So the shepherd's pecking order for water usage is first and foremost from a well, if there's a well nearby, then secondarily from a lagoon, because the hotter the summer becomes, the more the water is going to evaporate. So that's the water you want to use first for your sheep. And then you're holding your cistern water in reserve for the mid to late summer when the lagoon water has dried up. And now you can go to your protected water in your cisterns. And so I think one of the things that we need to understand here is that there's an awful lot of work, an awful lot of ingenuity, an awful lot of planning and anticipation that a shepherd does to provide water to his sheep. And this is what I really like. The sheep have no idea that all that effort has taken place. They just know they have water on a daily basis. And what a marvelous analogy that is for our Heavenly Father, who is the Good Shepherd. All the things he does that we're not even aware of to take care of our daily needs.
That's an astounding thought. That I just want to let that soak in for a second here. I'm thinking that civil engineering got its start. They had to be expert in so many things. What was the feel with regard to the land then? Was it generally felt that, especially in dry lands, that it was held in common? I mean, did people own portions of the hot, dry section of Judea and southward? Or was that just there for the public? I'm wondering about property rights, water rights. We deal with that stuff here. You know, if I was there and I'm thinking there are shepherds around that need water, I'm going to make a cistern and a lagoon my own business on my property. Was that a factor at all, the economics of land use there?
Much of the land, well, let me answer this question by way of analogy. When our first grandchild was in the sixth grade or left middle school, left elementary school to go to middle school, we decided that we would take her on a 2 weeks vacation trip anywhere she wanted to go, you know, as sort of to celebrate her graduating from elementary school. And she picked New England for a number of reasons. And so I began to build some other things into that trip. And so we ended up one day at Plymouth Plantation, south of Boston in Massachusetts, the first colony. And it's really interesting there. There's a reconstructed version of the first English settler village. And then you walk through a little bit of woods and you come across another reconstructed village of the Wampanoag Indians, who were the first Indians that the settlers had to deal with. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk with the Wampanoag Indians and you say, whose land is this? And they say, oh, this land is our the great white father, or the great father in the sky. It's his land, and he shares it with us. And because it's his land, we share it with everybody else as well. So if the settlers want to use this land, that's fine, you know. It's the great father in the sky's land, and he simply allows us to use this. Then you walk over to the English settler village, and you say to the guy who's got pigs and cattle in his wooden fence there, whose land is this? And he says, oh, this is my land. I said, well, why is it your land? Because we came over with a piece of paper from England, and the king said that this is our land. And so we're going to fence it because this is our land. And so you begin to see how two different worldviews here clash on whose land it is. One sees it from a grand communal perspective, and one sees it from a very selfish, individualistic perspective. And therein lies the clashes, the initial clashes that the Indians had with the settlers. Because the Indians would go hunting, and they would go hunt where they always, and fencing or non-fencing, it didn't make any difference. This was the great father in the sky's land. And then, of course, the English would say, no, you're trespassing, and we're going to persecute you for those crimes, and we're going to put you in jail. And all of that stems from how you view the land. Well, at the time of the first century, most of the land is not owned by anybody. And most of the land would not want to be owned by anybody. I mean, when you see how barren this land is and how rocky it is, it's not worth much of anything except for sheep and goat grazing. And so there's a lot of sharing. There's a lot of cooperation that goes on between the shepherds when it comes to water, because they know without water, death is right around the next corner. And that's not a viable option. And so they work out very elaborate ways of sharing, and they have their own built-in notions of stewardship. Hey, I found a great pasture here, but I'm not going to let my sheep chew it down and consume it all. I'm going to save some of it for other shepherds, and I want to make sure that they don't pull the roots out of the ground and erosion sets in and we lose this grassland. So that's a long-winded way of saying there's a lot of communal, ecologically minded thinking built into the paradigm of being a shepherd here in Judea that gets passed along from generation to generation.
Did the Romans add conflict to the mix? Did they have a Western notion of land ownership? Are you aware of that? I know it's a different aspect. But when they came and occupied the nation, and maybe it was different up north too, because when you're at a survival level, a subsistence level, as they were in the southern portions of Israel, you have that paradigm, as you say, that worldview, that cooperative sense that we all need to work together to survive here. But in the north of Israel, there's a little different feel. Did you find that same notion of land use true in northern Israel?
To be truthful, I've not investigated the notions of land use, land title, and contrasted it between north and south in the first century. That's just something that hasn't shown up on my horizon. But I'll let you know what my intuition is. Because the land in the north is much more productive land, there's going to be ownership rights and issues surrounding productive land. Mm-hmm. But in the south, except for grazing grass 8 weeks a year, this is not productive land at all. It can't be used for any other purposes. It's sort of land that nobody wants, and that maybe we could call it de facto communal land because of its very, very nature. So I would suspect if you could dig into this whole subject of land rights and what have you, you'd find a very different worldview from north to, not different worldview, very different understandings from north to south, because if it's productive, it's valuable.
Well, I'll tell you what, this allegory, I don't know what to call it, a parable, this parallel between shepherds providing for the sheep and the sheep not understanding in the slightest what's being done for them, how thoroughly, how completely they're being provided for. And just reflecting on that for a few minutes and looking at our Good Shepherd and feeling very much like a sheep. That's important. That's a big bright light in the day this morning, Doug.
Yeah, I think a final thought here would be ask yourself, what is it that sheep are capable of doing for themselves?
Yeah.
The answer is nothing.
Well,
the only thing they can do is get in trouble, actually. And they're actually pretty good at that. So it's really humbling that Jesus keeps, making references to his followers are like sheep without a shepherd and all those kind of things. Because when we really understand sheep, it is humbling. We are not nearly as proficient for providing and caring for ourselves as we might think. There's an awful lot going on behind the scenes. And I think that makes for a wonderful reflective period at certain points in our year to say, Holy Spirit, can you give me some idea of how much I have been cared for, how much I have been protected, how much I have been sustained that I'm not even aware of?
It's a powerful thought. We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. They're based in Columbia, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C. Well, I guess all of Maryland is just outside Washington, D.C., isn't it?
Well, some of it's a couple hundred miles away, where all the people live seems to be right around Washington, D.C.
Yeah, you can reach them at the website, preservingbibletimes.org, and you can link to that conveniently, we think, from our website. If you're listening this morning on brokenroadradio.com, there's a link to Preserving Bible Times over on the right-hand side of the homepage, and it's a good place to be. You can discover things for your church, for your if you're involved in a Bible study or small groups, just a great resource for that purpose there. And then Doug Greenwald, a great resource for Broken Road Radio. He joins us just about every Wednesday morning, normally during our 8 o'clock hour central, today an hour early because of Doug's schedule. But glad you could be flexible and join us an hour early. Appreciate it, Doug. Thank you.
Well, great. Well, we're not entirely done with water yet. We have to deal with the phrase, leads me beside still waters. So we'll pick up the still waters piece of this contextual restoration of shepherding next week.
We'll look forward to that. Doug, be blessed. Enjoy your week. Be safe.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Shalom.